The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. In the studio today in Campbell Hall, my guest is Francis Boyle. We're taping this a couple days before Labor Day weekend because we're going to be out of town. So this is not a time for you to call in. Just sit back, listen to us do the yakking here on Media Matters, and enjoy yourselves. Francis Boyle is a prominent law professor at the University of Illinois Law School, author of 8 books at last count, but going up actually as we speak, the total seems to be increasing. How many books is it, Francis?
The 8th will be coming out next year.
And expert in international law and constitutional law, who's received a great deal of acclaim, or not a great deal, but some acclaim, I should say, in the past 6 months specifically, because he's been leading the case that President George W. Bush should be impeached and removed from office. If that's not just Bush, if I'm not mistaken. You really go right down.
Down the chain of command.
When you're done impeaching people, we're going to have like the Secretary of State from Arkansas take over as next president by the time when you're through with everyone. I mean, how far down the chain of command are we going here?
Well, Bob, thanks again for having me on in this really fine program for the past year now that brings alternative voices to WILL that you cannot hear on the corporate-sponsored news media. On March 11th, of this year, Congressman John Conyers, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee.
Ranking Democrat.
Right.
And
well,
member, too.
And member.
Yeah.
That would have jurisdiction over a bill of impeachment, convened an emergency meeting of about 40 of his top advisors, most of whom were lawyers, to discuss putting in immediately before a war starts bills of impeachment against President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and Attorney General John Ashcroft. And Congressman Conyers invited former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, and me to come into this meeting and state the case for impeachment. So it was all four of them. The meeting went on for 2 hours, and it was a very vigorous debate, let me say. Mm-hmm. Congressman Conyers did not tip his hand. He moderated the debate between Clark and me on the one side, and it turned out most of the other lawyers there were against putting in these bills of impeachment to stop the war. Their basic objection was not a legal objection or a constitutional objection that Bush at all did not deserve to be impeached. It was more a tactical objection. Almost all these lawyers are affiliated with the Democratic National Committee. I'm not. I'm a political independent. I work with politicians of all different political stripes. And they felt at the time that putting in bills of impeachment before the war started would hurt the Democratic candidates running for the 2004 presidential election. It is curious in retrospect that at the end of July, of course, Senator Bob Graham of Florida, who is running for the presidency, publicly called for the impeachment of President Bush.
And largely on the grounds that you were arguing in March?
Well, among many other, we argued, Ramsey and I, we went across the board. Mm-hmm. It was a two-hour meeting. There was at this meeting already drawn up a second revised draft bill of impeachment. That's how serious this was. Mm-hmm. This wasn't just, you know, an exercise or anything. We had on the table in front of us a second revised draft bill. You can read my draft bill on counterpunch.org, January 16 or 17, 2003. And then Ramsey drafted his bill. I believe you can find it at the International Answer webpage. They have Ramsey's bill. This was a revised composite bill. So we were talking about a bill. There must have been, I have it, it's still in confidence, but there must have been 25 different items of President Bush. And we went through them, although, you know, the discussion was at a very general level, given the number of issues involved. The most serious issue, of course, was war and the threatened war. And the
before you go into the war for one second, so if I get it straight, so just to clarify here, when you had this discussion that Conyers convened and moderated Representative Conyers, there wasn't really debate over the facts and the fact that clearly what the president had done to that point justified impeachment. I mean, the facts, that was more or less agreed upon. It was a tactical concern that this would not be politically a smart move if your goal is to get rid of this president.
That is correct. And then the I didn't argue that point. I'm not a Democrat.
No, you
so
were,
it's not for me to tell Democrats how to elect their people. Well, I was there as
I was
an
just
expert.
Interested in what the nature of the conflict or the concern was, a tactical one, not a principled
and
one.
Then the second concern was that if Congressman Conyers and some of the other Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee were to do this, it would hurt their agenda in other areas.
Yeah,
that was a secondary concern.
Yeah.
But
well, let's go with
the only, again, to be fair, the only one substantive debate we had, Julian Epstein, you see him, he's a talking head and a lawyer, close to the DNC, did raise the status of Congress's war powers resolution. Saying that he didn't think any court would strike that down. And I responded by saying, first, well, since
why don't you clarify for listeners who might not be familiar with Congress's War Powers Resolution, what that is?
Last October, pursuant to the terms of the War Powers Resolution of 1973, Congress passed a resolution authorizing President Bush to use force against Iraq basically on two conditions. One, if he believed that there was a dire national security threat to the United States. And two, if he had to certify that, and he also had to certify that he had exhausted all means for the peaceful resolution of this dispute. Clearly, as we know now, the president lied to Congress about the weapons of mass destruction and the fact that there was no dire national security threat to the United States. This is the point Senator Graham made.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we in the peace movement knew he was lying, but it was not yet a matter of public record. The response I made to Epstein was basically, one, well, it wouldn't surprise me if a court wouldn't rule against that because you've had, under Reagan, Bush Sr., and 2 years of Bush Jr., the federal courts packed by right-wing, racist, bigoted, reactionary judges from the Federalist Society, which we can talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
But two, we're talking here of the obligations of Congress, not the courts. There's a system of balance of power, separation of powers, and we're talking about Congress's responsibility. The argument on the tactics for the 2004 campaign were made by John Podesta, and he just said, well, this will hurt us getting Democrats elected in 2004, and all the Democrats will be asked what they think about this. Well, that's now irrelevant because Senator Graham has already called for the president to be impeached.
Now, if I can interject here, for listeners who are just joining us, I'm talking to Francis Boyle, the law professor from the University of Illinois, today on Media Matters. I'm the host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it just before Labor Day weekend to air over the weekend because I'll be out of town. the case for impeachment that you laid out in March, that Senator Graham of Florida said, look, we should be consider impeaching, or actually said, let's go ahead and impeach the president because he lied to us about the war. Where does it stand now here at the end of August? I mean, is this already passed into the memory hole of our political culture, or is this issue, are we at the beginning of something?
I think we're now at the beginning. What happened is, you know, at the end of the meeting, Congressman Conyers let me have the final say, and I did offer to stay in Washington as long as it took to fine-tune these bills of impeachment, but that offer was not taken up. We went home. The war started. Ramsey and I continued our impeachment campaigns. Ramsey's doing a vote to impeach. I have a committee of students here. We're organizing lobbying with members of Congress. I have an ad campaign that's going nationwide. So we will keep forward. Now, during the summer, then, there were three developments. The National Green Party, that I had been working with on this for a while, finally did publicly endorse the impeachment of President Bush and the rest of them. You can find this on their webpage.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Nader did. Then Senator Bob Graham, who is a Democrat running for president, came out because clearly the president had lied about war. And there, Scheer in the L.A. Times has called for impeachment. Jules Witkover in the Baltimore Sun ran an article on it. This was before the lies came out, saying, I don't know if we're there yet, but we're getting there.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress is now on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have to see what happens when Congress resumes on September 10th.
Aside from Bob Graham, have any other elected officials or Democrats? I doubt any Republicans are going to come forward in this one, but Democrats?
Dennis Kucinich has said no, but that was before all the lies about going to war came out.
Mm-hmm.
So we will have people going in and talk to him. We have people talking to Bernie Sanders, who is an independent. We have people talking to Ron Paul, who's mm-hmm. a Republican and a libertarian. So we have a list of people. We're not giving up on anyone. And indeed, people who are Republicans contacting me are disgusted with this. And I'm encouraging them to go in and talk to their members of Congress, including here at Tim Johnson, and tell them they've had it. And they want them to do something about it. And the theory here is that message is going to get back to the White House, because just yesterday the president gave a speech before the American Legion threatening more preventive warfares. So we need to stop these people.
The last time I had you on the program, which is, I think, over a year ago or roughly a year ago, Francis, we talked about this doctrine of preventative warfare as a justification for invading other countries. What is this doctrine, and what is its legal status? If you could, just for our listeners who are unfamiliar with this, because it's not a term that's used a great deal in the news media.
No, it isn't, and there's a good reason why it isn't, because it really goes back to the Nuremberg judgment of 1946 in the trial of the major Nazi war criminals. And here, one of the components of the charge, crime against peace, was the Nazi invasion of Norway. And the lawyers for the Nazis argued this was a preventive war. We had to invade Norway before Britain did. And the Nuremberg Tribunal, which, by the way, was President Roosevelt's idea, condemned this doctrine of preventive warfare and articulated the standard for going to war that is still the case today, namely the necessity of self-defense must be instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means, no moment for deliberation.
And that's the official wording?
Yes.
Memorized it?
And I've written about it quite extensively.
Mm-hmm.
There are other holdings by the International Court of Justice, the Corfu Channel case and the Nicaragua case, which was filed against the United States the Reagan administration. But the rejection of this doctrine really goes back to to Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. And that is why we've never really seen since Nuremberg in any war that our government has engaged in that I'm aware of, justified in terms of a doctrine of preventive warfare.
If I, just for the sake of people who aren't lawyers, for example, when the United States fought in Vietnam, legally it was working with an existing government in Vietnam.
Right. They did not use any doctrine of preventive warfare there. President Johnson made a disingenuous argument that pursuant to the terms of the CETO Treaty, the United States could come to the defense of a protocol of states listed in a protocol, but that's the best they could do. No one's really argued. I mean, we've gone to war several times, but no one has tried to argue what can only be charitably called the Nazi doctrine of preventive warfare since Nuremberg.
One other example along these lines, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, I believe, it theoretically came to the aid of an existing government that invited it in. Was it an example of this preventative warfare?
They didn't argue that. What the Soviets did, they landed a Spetsnaz team that killed, murdered the current president at that time of Afghanistan. They then brought in a puppet, and then the puppet invited them in.
Yeah.
That was their legal justification. But they never tried to argue a doctrine of preventive warfare. And that's why this is so dangerous, because this was pointed out in the debate we had with Congressman Conyers by one of the members, saying that if we didn't act now, what's to prevent Bush using the same doctrine from attacking Iran, which they've threatened to do. They've threatened to attack North Korea. They threatened to attack Syria. Indeed, they did attack Syria in June. On the alleged grounds of hot pursuit, which does not apply to land warfare. So they invaded Syria, they killed some guards, they abducted the rest, and they came out. So, as I said yesterday, the president rearticulated this doctrine in front of the American Legion and said there's still enemies out there that we're going to have to preempt.
You know, this is, we talked about this before, but it's worth noting. If you do have a notion of preventive warfare as a doctrine that this permits invasions, it obviously leads to the question, well, who gets to decide who gets to invade and who gets to be the one who does the invading and who's the invadee? It's the law of the jungle, I think, as you put it, as the headline of one of your articles that I've read. But, I mean, if this is the case, this preventive warfare doctrine, that it opens up this really dubious territory of militarism. How is the rest of the world responding? I mean, is there actions going on globally to stop the United States by other nations, or is there approval of it? Where does the United Nations stand on something like this?
Well, as you note, in the run-up to the Iraq War, no one agreed with the Bush position except Tony Blair. Everyone rejected this argument. Putin, Chirac, Schroeder. All the Arab world, the Muslim world, no one accepts this doctrine except Tony Blair. Indeed, what became worse is that in September of 2002, this doctrine of preventive warfare was officially enshrined in the so-called National Security Strategy document. It's an official government document. And I won't go through it all. If you read it, it reads like one of these Nazi war plans that would be introduced at Nuremberg. But the worst language is the best defense is a good offense. Now, I could take this document and file it at the International Court of Justice in The Hague as an admission against interest with respect to the United States government that we are now officially committed to engage in offensive wars of aggression that constitute Nuremberg crimes against peace. That is our official standing policy as I speak today and as recently articulated yesterday by the president in his speech before the American Legion, which is why my next book is entitled Destroying World Order. We're really going back now under this new doctrine and destroying the Nuremberg Charter, judgment, and principles, the Kellogg-Briand Peace Pact of 1928, which was ours, the Stimson Doctrine, the United Nations Charter, the rulings by the World Court in the Corfu Channel case, the Nicaragua case. There's really nothing left if this is the way the United States government is going to proceed.
Well, how do you get rid of these bad guys around the world if you know, the good guys can't go in and take them out?
Well, we've done a pretty effective job of that prior to Bush Jr. There was no complaint that the United Nations Charter wasn't working or couldn't work or couldn't be used. We've got along quite well. Indeed, during the Cold War with the Soviet Union, the situation was far more serious, the security situation, than it is today. And we did quite well without embracing a Nazi ideology of preventive warfare.
And one of the questions that, you know, we've talked about in the past and you've mentioned just before we went on air today with the notion of preventive warfare, if in fact that is the operating logic, then why would Iraq be the first country you would have at the top of your list of countries you have to take out if you're the United States? By that logic, wouldn't North Korea, which actually possesses nuclear weapons or claims to and claims a willingness to use them against the United States, be shouldn't they be ranked higher on the list? I mean, how does that, you know, pecking order get established?
Well, of course, Iraq was at the top of the list because it had 11% of the world's oil resources. And second, it had been materially and psychologically weakened since the Bush Sr. Gulf War. So they were ripe for the picking. They could easily come in, destroy Iraq, take over the oil fields, which is what they're doing now. Today's New York Times reports that they're now busy privatizing the entire Iraqi economy and putting up to the highest bidders from the West. So that was a pretty easy thing to do. And Noam Chomsky has made this point that typically the United States government likes to attack and invade states that can't really defend itself, like Grenada or Nicaragua or pretty small little countries mm-hmm. where the costs are minimal. Panama, there's a long history of this. North Korea is another matter. As we speak today, they have just stated their intention to announce that they are a nuclear power and they're going to go ahead with a nuclear explosion. I don't know if that is true. If they have that capability, I guess we'll have to see if they actually do explode a nuclear device. In this case, of course, there would be enormous casualties on the Korean peninsula, certainly for the Korean people and the 36,000 United States Armed Forces that are in Korea today as we speak. So the costs are much higher. The disincentives are there.
And your argument is, if I understand it, that there are already existing mechanisms within international law to deal with countries like North Korea. It doesn't require one government taking it upon itself the onus to go in and invade this country, overthrow it, and take over the country to protect the rest of the world.
That's correct. I mean, the United Nations Charter, which, again, was our idea, going back to President Roosevelt, has a mechanism for collective security, and it worked quite well for all those years of the Cold War and the post-Cold War era.
We're talking to Francis Boyle, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it a few days before Labor Day weekend, so please don't call in. Just sit back and listen. We're talking about the case for impeaching President George W. Bush. Francis Boyle has been leading this campaign as a leading constitutional lawyer in the United States, an international law expert. And we've been talking about the grounds for impeachment. A couple more things I want to talk about on impeachment, Francis, before we move on to some other issues. First of all, the press coverage. You know, how much press coverage has there been of this case? How would you evaluate the quality and caliber of it in the U.S. news media compared to the enormity of the gravity of the situation?
Well, it also has to do with the press coverage of the war itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a personal experience I'll share with you. I've been invited on to a lot of news media, but I had a good relationship with MSNBC at one point before the war started. And a producer called. He wanted me to go on to talk about CIA assassinations and whatever. And we were talking about the war coverage. This is a producer at MSNBC. And they were the best up until that point in time of the mainstream networks. And this producer said, yes, all the other networks are running towards war, but we here at MSNBC are walking towards war. And then what happened? They fired Phil Donahue, mm-hmm. who was the only talk show host trying to bring in a progressive voice. They then hired this guy, Savage, who they later fired because of anti-Semitic, homophobic, and racist comments he made, a total warmonger. They hired Scarborough.
Scarborough.
They hired Scarborough, who still worships Ronald Reagan. I'm not sure where you get a dinosaur like that, but he's on there. And then they fired Peter Arnett, who was the only American network correspondent in Baghdad. And they fired him. And I haven't been asked back since on MSNBC, mm-hmm. and I don't anticipate being asked back. And they were the best of the mainstream news media. Curiously, on the after Senator Graham announced his support for impeaching President Bush, in fairness, a producer did ask me to go on to Fox and also ABC News. But mm-hmm. I was leaving town on vacation, and I have three sons, and they did not want me to be disrupting our vacation by going into a studio somewhere. So we'll have to see what happens. But just this week, for example, the Financial Times of London had a big story, on Bush's problems. And in the center was a big photograph of a peace demonstration with someone holding a sign right in the foreground saying impeach Bush. And right behind him was another one saying impeach Bush. So the message is out there. Indeed, if you do a Google.com search on the news and you hit impeach Bush, at every peace rally in the country and protests and demonstrations, everyone's out there with signs and bumper stickers and slogans saying impeach Bush. And it is now slowly being taken, I think, seriously by mainstream news media such as the Financial Times or Fox.
Yeah, not the slow, I think, crawling towards the story of walking was what MSNBC said before regarding the war, because you know, you consider that 5 years ago there was another impeachment scandal in the United States, this one concerning President Clinton and his crime of lying about whether he had a sexual dalliance with Monica Lewinsky. And that was, if I understand it, and you can correct me because you're the lawyer here, that was the real basis of the charges, that he actually lied about whether he had oral sex.
That's the gist of it. If you read the Ken Starr report, and I've given many interviews on it, it's pretty pornographic. I mean, mm-hmm. it's basically sex and lying about sex. And here we have war and lying about war, which constitutionally is quite different.
Yeah. Now, the Lewinsky story got a lot of coverage early on and extensive, obviously. This story has gotten, despite the recent picture in the newspaper, virtually no coverage whatsoever. I think the vast majority
That's
of
correct.
Americans have been no exposure to this, whereas I think 5 years ago, safe to say, within 1 week of the Lewinsky thing being publicized, every American alive knew about it. Even people in comas probably have been waving newspapers in their face about it. And what, I mean, in terms of how would you compare these two cases? I mean, was the Clinton case that much more powerful of a case that it deserved more attention?
Well, if you go back to the Philadelphia Convention where the Constitution was drafted, and of course the records are sparse, but the test for impeachment was behavior that, quote, subverted, unquote, the Constitution. That was the test applied in the Nixon impeachment resolution on each of the articles, that at the end of the article it said his behavior subverted the Constitution. In the resolution of impeachment I did with the late, great Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas against Bush Sr., we too alleged that Bush Sr.'s behavior subverted the Constitution. If you read the Clinton bill of impeachment, they could not with a straight face allege that his behavior subverted the Constitution. What they alleged was that his behavior subverted the rule of law. And, you know, arguably it did. I think people of good faith and goodwill can disagree about Clinton. But clearly a fortiori, here we have subversion of the Constitution, war, and lying about war. At Philadelphia, again, our founders extensively debated the war powers, who should have the right to go to war. And there were several different variants on this question of separation of powers, checks and balances, etc. Finally, the decision was made that the decision to go to war was the most awesome decision our republic could make. And therefore, for that reason, that war powers had to be put into the hands of both houses of Congress acting together. The president would have nothing to do with it. The Senate could not do it alone because at that time it was not popularly elected. Only the House was. Of course, putting aside women, blacks, black slaves, and American Indians, and poor whites.
Yeah,
right. But putting them aside.
Yeah.
But in theory, that was there. And so they put that power into the hands of both houses of Congress acting together. And that is one of our leading charges against President Bush, that he lied to Congress to procure war powers resolution authorization against Iraq. Senator Graham has said this. Congressman Waxman has said it. I haven't keeping count, but I suspect there are others who have said it too.
You know, one of the things that has struck me, just I'm concluding on this point about the comparison with the Clinton impeachment case, as I recall, in fact, I've seen printed recently on the internet, on I think Counterpunch's website, in fact, counterpunch.org, I've seen all these sort of emphatic statements by politicians in 1998 that, okay, that basically conceding that it didn't seem like that big of an issue whether he lied about his sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, but the principle was what was at stake here. He lied under oath, and that alone meant he should be removed from office. Because nothing short of that would be acceptable. And many of these were prominent members of the Republican Party, like Tom DeLay. How have they responded? How is this principle held up under the new facts that they've faced with George W. Bush?
Unfortunately, they have not adhered to their principles, as far as I can tell right now. Maybe things will change. And again, I went through the whole Starr referral and was involved in all this and followed it quite extensively. I understand there are some people of good faith and goodwill out there who believes that, that the president should have been impeached for lying under oath. But if you believe that, then a fortiori, you have to support the impeachment of President Bush for lying about war.
Yeah. We're talking to Francis Boyle today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Robert McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. This is a show we recorded a few days before the Labor Day weekend because I'm going to be out of town. So don't try to call in today. And when we refer to today's newspaper or yesterday's newspaper or something, we're referring to a few days before Sunday, not to Sunday. Francis Boyle, you've written eight books now, a ninth coming up. And in addition to working on the case for impeachment and arguing against this doctrine of preventive war, which you characterize as being a doctrine originated and perfected by the Nazis in their invasion of Norway in 1940, if I'm not mistaken.
It was during the Second World War.
April
right.
1940. Right. I should know this. My wife's Norwegian. I've got to know this sort of stuff. You've also been active in a number of other areas you've written about, including a book, a recent book on Palestine and the rights of the Palestinians. I don't think there's any more controversial subject that I've done on this show since we started. In fact, the only time we've had irate calls on this program is when we did a show that talked about Israel and Palestine. What is your book about? What's your argument there? What's the legal argument you have with regard to Palestine?
Right. Well, it's called Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law. I've been involved in this issue, I guess, since the 1967 war, studying it, and then when I came here, writing about it, lecturing, and eventually I served as the legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace negotiations from 1991 to 1993. And one of the assignments I received from the head of the delegation, Dr. Haider Abdel-Shafi, my client, my friend, was to draw up the Palestinian alternative to the now defunct Oslo Agreement. The Oslo Agreement was the drafted by the Israeli government and basically approved by President Arafat with almost no material changes. But it was my job to come up with the alternative. This book tries to deal with the entire legal history of the Palestine problem, going back to the League of Nations mandate for Palestine that was given to Britain by the League of Nations, and takes the story up through my involvement at the peace negotiations, mm-hmm. Through the Camp David II negotiations, up until we even had a postscript in there on the roadmap,
mm-hmm.
And trying to keep it up to date as possible. And then including the concluding chapter dealing with the Israeli divestment-disinvestment campaign that I launched at a speech at Illinois State University. Now it's almost 3 years ago, and has expanded to include about 70 campuses all over the country. And the conclusion is intended to serve as sort of a manual for people in the divestment movement. Obviously, you can't in one book cover the entire Middle East from 1917 until 2003. So I concentrated on the legal, human rights, laws of war aspects, as well as the peace negotiations. Today, for example, the state of Palestine has de facto, but not yet de jure, UN membership. I've advised them on that. So it's an entire complex of issues that if you get a book on the Middle East, for example, my friend Cheryl Rubenberg just came out with a new book. She just sent me a copy. I haven't had a chance to read it. And she has another book by the U of I Press, Israel and the American National Interest, which is an excellent book. I'd encourage you to read it. But it doesn't really get down to the nitty-gritty technical legal types of issues. And that's why the Palestinians retained me to serve as their legal advisor, because I know this stuff.
Yeah, for the sake of our listeners, what's the basis of the Palestinian legal claims? I assume you think they've got a pretty a strong legal case for their rights that is currently, you know, they're getting a raw deal. What is their case legally?
Well, I wrote a whole book on it.
I know.
But you'll have to read it. But in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, yeah.
In a nutshell, when the General Assembly partitioned the mandate for Palestine in Resolution 181, it called for the creation of two states, one for the Jewish people, one for the Palestinian people, with an international trusteeship for the city of Jerusalem. That Resolution 181, Israel asserted as the basis for its right to independence in its Declaration of Independence.
This is now going back to 1948.
That's correct. And second, when Israel was admitted into the United Nations in the early 1950s, and I have all the documentation and everything in my book, they were required to officially accept Resolution 181, calling for a Palestinian state with a trusteeship for Jerusalem, and also Resolution 194 on the right of return for the Palestinian refugees. And I have the official statements made by Abba Ibn where they accept this. Mm-hmm. So the obviously there's a lot more than that. But in a very brief nutshell, these are promises and commitments they have already made. And indeed, they got UN membership by making these commitments. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I pointed out in my book is that their UN membership could be in jeopardy if they don't honor these commitments. And that's been reported in the Israeli news media.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that obviously that's a very technical legal thing, which, you know, you can read about in my book with all the footnotes and everything
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the news media, that the Israeli news media is covering the fact that Israel might be in trouble keeping its membership at the UN because it's violating the promises it made upon entering the UN. How, over the years, you've been involved in this issue for a long time now, how would you characterize the coverage of Israel-Palestine relationship in the U.S. news media? For the knowledge you have, and since seeing how it's covered, is there a disconnect there?
Oh, and by the way, Bob, I should point out, now President Bush himself, this president, has called for the creation of the Palestinian state. The Security Council has called for the creation of a Palestinian state. And last fall, even Ariel Sharon publicly admitted the Palestinians already have their state. So really what they're arguing about now is, what is that going to be, a real state or a Bantustan?
Mm-hmm.
The news media coverage here in the United States is completely atrocious. It's almost all pro-Israel. I don't know of any exception to that general rule. Pretty much you're wasting your time trying to find out anything meaningful or significant, not only on the Israeli Palestinian dispute, but on the Middle East in general. It's basically pro-Israel, pro-U.S. government propaganda. I was fortunate at the University of Chicago after the 67 war. I decided I had to learn more about the Middle East. I had been raised to believe that Israel was the David and the Arab states were the Goliath, but the 67 war proved the reverse was true. And at the University of Chicago, I took an outstanding course in the Middle East by Professor Leonard Binder, who actually had fought in Israel's war for independence. And he's one of the great Middle East scholars in this country. And to his credit, Professor Binder was very fair, reasonable, and open-minded, and in the course fully presented the Palestinian claims and the other Arab claims. Likewise, at Harvard Law School, Professor Louis Sohn, my teacher, my friend, who had fled the Nazis in Poland. He was a Polish Jew. In his course on United Nations law, mm-hmm. Presented very fairly the Palestinian and other Arab claims. But you're simply not going to get the truth by following this matter in the U.S. News media. You'll find out more in the Israeli news media, which is more honest and open. And now that you can, you have the access to the internet, I get their material put into my computer every day. So yes, you'll get better coverage in the Israeli news media than you will in America.
Okay, for those of us who aren't going to be admitted to the Harvard Law School and are not fluent in Hebrew, where can we go to learn? Where would you recommend people look to try to stay, get another perspective in this issue from what they'll get in the U.S. news media?
Well, Marvin Weinbaum, who used to teach here, my good friend, was very good on the Middle East.
Let's say people aren't going to go to school.
Now Ken Cuno runs it. I think Ken here on campus does a pretty good job.
But in terms of media?
I would recommend counterpunch.org.
Mm-hmm. Who you write for periodically.
I write for them a lot. And I think they have very good, hard-hitting coverage. There are a lot of Israelis who write there, American Jews. And others. Mm-hmm. And I think right now that's probably the best coverage you're going to get about what's going on. I would also recommend you read anything written by Noam Chomsky, who, by the way, is one of the most prominent Jewish American intellectuals, and Edward Said, who's one of the most prominent Palestinian American intellectuals. You'll see, if you read Chomsky and Said, a high degree of congruence on what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. They don't agree on everything, but an enormous amount.
We're talking to Francis Boyle today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so please do not try to call in. Francis Boyle is a lawyer, a professor of law at the University of Illinois Law School, an expert on international and constitutional law. He's leading the fight in the case for impeaching President George W. Bush on a number of counts. He's also worked on behalf of Palestine and written widely on both these. Well, you haven't written on the impeachment necessarily, have you? You had a book, but you've written articles on it, certainly at counterpunch.org.
Right. Yeah,
I suspect a book might be in the
works. The book will have a chapter. It's entitled Impeaching President George W. Bush, and it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. I review the Nixon, the Bush Sr. that I did for Congressman Gonzalez, Clinton, and Bush Jr., and the progress we're making there.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, and I'd like to – you. In one of the pieces I read of yours recently, you talked about going up, I think, to Chicago and giving a talk about Palestine, if I'm not mistaken, at Loyola or University of Chicago, one of the schools up there. And got somewhat of a frosty reception from some of the people.
This is Loyola Law School. New Orleans.
Oh, New Orleans.
It was New Orleans.
New Orleans,
right.
Okay.
No, actually, I got a standing ovation at the end of that speech. And I think in lecturing on the Middle East now, I think the first lecture I ever gave on the Middle East was right after I graduated from Harvard Law School in 1976. The Harvard International Law Society actually asked me to give a lecture, which I did. This is the first time I've ever gotten a standing ovation on the Middle East. And that is a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the Jewish Federation of New Orleans did not really like what I had to say.
Mm-hmm.
What can I say?
Yeah,
they didn't like it. Although, you know, it was interesting. They did accurately present my comments in mm-hmm. their article and what I had to say, and then proceeded to criticize it. So, okay.
Actually, it was my mistake. I meant to refer to an article you wrote about the University of Chicago, and the reason it's your alma mater.
Right.
And the reason I wanted to bring it up is you mentioned there a group we talked about earlier in the show that I don't think many of our listeners probably know about, called the Federalist Society, but it's widely known in the legal community.
Sure.
And I think it's an interesting group. Why don't you tell – what is the Federalist Society? What's their origins? What's their function? And what sort of stature do they have in our society today?
Right. Well, I first got to know about them when, for some reason, the University of Illinois College of Law – invited then Attorney General Edwin Meese to come here to the University of Illinois to give the keynote university-wide address in honor of the 200th anniversary of the Constitution, which was appalling. And I think I said to the News Gazette at the time, I said, well, you know, that's like asking Attila the Hun to say a few words in honor of virginity. Here, Meese is under investigation by two special prosecutors, Walsh for Iran-Contra and McKay in the WedTech. And by the way, later both of them found he had committed criminal activity, although they declined to comment. So, of course, I launched a campaign at the law school to disinvite Meese and at university-wide with the chancellor at that time. And when that didn't work, we decided to have a people's symposium in honor of the Constitution right outside the Krannert Center, which mm-hmm. we did. It was very successful. We got more publicity than Meese did. And we invited in all the poor, the oppressed, and the downtrodden. In any event, to do all this, I had to study about the Federalist Society because Meese was on their board of directors. He still is, by the way. He's one of the founders, a guy like Meese. Bob Bork, who... as you know, was the hatchet man for Tricky Dick Nixon, who fired the first independent counsel special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. So Meese and Bork are two of the big wheels, as it were, behind the Federalist Society. It's been heavily funded by the Bradley Foundation, the Scaife Foundation, and others.
These are very conservative foundations.
It basically, as Judge Lawrence Walsh called them, you know, he said this is the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. Right wing, racist, bigoted, reactionary, warmongering. And Judge Walsh was Deputy Attorney General for President Eisenhower and a conservative Republican himself. And he not only condemned them, he analogized them to the Ku Klux Klan. So because of this experience fighting Mies, and, you know, being fairly successful, I've been involved in the battles against the Federalist Society. And indeed, finally, Bork, in a mass mailing fundraising letter to the members of the Federalist Society, attacked in the same letter both Judge Walsh and me.
Oh, congratulations.
And I thought that was just wonderful. When I told my mother, she was really proud that Bork sent a letter out to 25,000 members of the Federalist Society attacking both Judge Lawrence Walsh and me.
Now, the Federalist Society is a bunch of lawyers, right? I mean, that's why it's not like, can anyone join it? Or is it basically meant for people who are law students and lawyers?
Yeah,
and
basically
legal
lawyers and law students.
And but their influence has grown, if I understand it, because many of the judges that have been appointed by Reagan and the first Bush, now George W. Bush, come out of the Federalist
Society.
Almost
all of them do. Indeed, C. Boyden Gray is reported to have said that none of the Reagan appointments made it unless they were Federalist Society members. Likewise, Bush Sr. And now even more so with Bush Jr.
Now, what's the relationship of the Federalist Society? This, I'm not a lawyer. What's the relationship of the Federalist Society to, like, the American Bar Association?
You know, it's very interesting. If you read the public debate, you would think that the Federalist Society is to the far right and the ABA is to the far left. That isn't true. I've been a member of the ABA since 1977 when I was first licensed to practice law. The ABA is a very conservative institution of lawyers. I would not say it's overly liberal at all based on my involvement and active membership since 1977. That should give you an idea of how extreme to the right the Federalist Society really is. And today they are engaged in the process. Even Bork himself said, now that we've taken over the federal judiciary, we're going to take over the law schools. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're attempting to put their people on law school faculties and infiltrate law school faculties, including our own.
Francis Boyle, we are drawing near the end of our time. It's been a real pleasure having you on the air. If people want to find one of your books, what can they do? Do you have a website or anything?
I don't keep a website to avoid problems, but if you hit Amazon.com, they
enter
list,
Francis Boyle, and
right
under
my name, you'll find most of my books.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, and this is Bob McChesney. I'll be back in a week. I'd like to thank Andrew Boyle, who's been my producer for the past several months and done a wonderful job, was leaving today, and thank you, Andrew, and see you all in 167 hours.